Welcome to another episode of The Textual Talk, where we break down all things tech, careers, and personal journeys in the industry. In today's episode, HD sits down with special guest CJ, aka Cloud Tech Exec, a familiar face from TikTok and Instagram, known for his insightful takes on tech careers and cloud engineering. The conversation dives deep into Mr. CJ's personal and professional path from his upbringing in the Virgin Islands and his first-generation immigrant experience to finding his unique place and the U.S. tech landscape. Together, they explore how curiosity for video games turned into a fascination for computers, eventually propelling CJ from college athlete to cloud expert. They pull back the curtain on what it really takes to break into the industry and grow within cloud and DevOps roles, discussing the realities of choosing cloud providers, the value of hands-on learning versus books, and how to strategically pursue certifications. The pair doesn't shy away from tough truths either, exploring challenges like job rejections, the real no one cares mindset, and why balancing technical prep with genuine interview skills is a game changer. Along the way, you'll get insights into the broken interview and recruiting processes, the evolution of the help desk in the age of cloud computing, automation and security operations, and how to keep your skills sharp and your negotiation game strong. Whether you're just starting out or seeking the next cloud promotion, this episode is jam-packed with candid advice, hard-won lessons, and practical strategies straight from the field. So buckle up and let's take this ride. Welcome back to the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD. And first and foremost, y'all know what to do. If you're listening in the car right now, please leave us a review, follow the podcast, and share it out. But if you're watching on YouTube right now, just hit the like button. And if you want to subscribe, hit the bell icon and hit all so you'll be notified when we're dropping our content. And today we have none other than Mr. CJ, aka Mr. Cloud Tech Exec. You've probably seen him on TikTok or IG interviewing or reacting to a lot of content. And I was funny because I thought about doing a segment when I say, as an incident response analyst, because you know, everything, your thing
yeah,
is like,
yeah. And I've seen other people starting to do that as well too. Like, it was cool to come in and have something unique like that. Man, I'm not gonna stop doing it.
It works.
It's gonna be fire. I'm gonna do some more stuff like that too.
But no, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mr. CJ to the show.
What's going on, guys? I'm grateful to be here, honestly. Like, I want to start getting some more content out there, and I figured like this is probably one of the best places to start. Someone who's mature in the space, pumps out great content, and like is actually in the field and knows what they're talking about. So pleasure to be here. Like,
yeah, nah, like, and guys, background, I think I listened in a little bit. Mm-hmm. The day that we shot all our stuff with Justice, you were working. Yeah. So I was like, he actually does work. He's not a person that's just lying.
I was interviewing like upstairs the day that things were getting shot too. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. You gotta, man, some people aren't legit, man. And it's good to be around people that are actually like that.
Yeah, man, but just give like a brief intro about yourself, like background, where you're from, because I believe that you aren't from the U.S.?
Yeah. So I'm from the Virgin Islands. I'm the first generation immigrant. I don't know what the actual term is, but I'm the first U.S. citizen, like, of my lineage from my parents. So they're both from Dominica, and then I'm from St. Thomas specifically in the Virgin Islands. So both my parents are from the same island. I'm from a different island, but it's U.S. territory, so I was U.S. citizen. But I mean, more or less, like, a lot of the things that I've done at this point in my life, career, whatever, like, it's the first time it's being done for my family. So, or, like, by someone in my family. And it's very, I don't know, it's like you're watching yourself from a third party view do things that you didn't really expect. So, like, a lot of things are being done for the first time. It's kind of thrilling, to say the least.
Now, I want to ask you, too, because, you know, a lot of us, and me included, are ignorant to technically, you know, U.S. territory, but mm-hmm. that's not the first thing people think of when they think about, like, America. They think about it being rural, it's not city, and all different things.
Okay, the island that my parents are from, yeah, it's like that. Like, I remember when I was, I don't want to say nothing graphic, but the island that my parents are from, if something happened to you, it would be a very long time before, like, authorities actually came. Like, the places that you're thinking of, or like the places that Americans would think of as like actually out of the way or just underdeveloped, those places exist. Where I grew up, not so much. I mean, they still use the US dollar, but everything was just like considerably more expensive, but it definitely wasn't the cities and skyscrapers that you would think of in Atlanta. It's still very much like, if you wanted to go into the forest and do your own thing, you could, very much so. If you wanted to go to a more segregated part of the island, you could. But also, there's still like the touristy places. I don't know if any of you guys have been like to Mexico or like other touristy parts of the world. You have that touristy area, but if you want to go find something that you're looking for, you can go and find it for sure.
So how do you get interested in even getting a technology career? Like, at one point did y'all, were you working on this when you're at St. Thomas, or did you move over here and then decide that's when you're going to start getting into tech or something?
Yeah, when I got over here, older cousin that I had, he was like super into video games. He was very like, no joke, he's actually a neat, like a neat. If any of you guys watch anime, he's legitimately a neat. And when I was younger, it was like fascinating for me to like see different video games or different things on a computer. And I had like an affinity for that as I was a kid. Like, and then I liked RPG games specifically. I like JRPGs. I like different genres of like adventure games and such. And then from there, like clearly you need a computer, you need a console to play it. So it would just be me breaking things or just playing video games that really like sparked my curiosity there. And then my parents did not like it. My mom did not like it. Like, there were points where she'd be like, yeah, like, I'm taking away your video game, taking away your computer. And it's like, dang, I'm making, not making, but I'm doing really well. And it's like, dang, what if I had more time when I was younger to cultivate that skill? Like, where would I have been? But from that, when I went to college, I ended up going to college for athletics. So it was for like wrestling. I ended up getting injured. It didn't work out. It was like, for those of you who are athletes who have gotten to that level, it's either you're hyper competitive and you're a top 1%er, or there's no point in you being there, quite honestly, unless you're like there for the college experience, in my opinion. But, and I was like, oh, well, let me just try something that I know that I'm good at. It wasn't like my thought process was to make income or do other things. It was like, let me do something that I know I have an affinity for. And I ended up, you know, niching down with computer science, realized I hated software development, got an amazing opportunity with a pretty brand name company at the start, just off like being in the space. And I mean, it was history from there, like picking up the concepts outside of software development. Like when I got exposed to the cloud for the first time, it was like, oh, this makes perfect sense. It was like, I don't know, it was just like breathing at that point. But that's what led me there.
Worried about building a future-proof tech skill set, especially with the rise of AI making it harder to stay relevant? The answer for 2025 is clear. Focus on cloud skills. This video is brought to you by Cloud Tech Exec, an IT professional with 8 years of experience in cloud engineering. They've created a thriving community of over 3,000 members, all dedicated to helping you land your target cloud engineering role. Cloud Tech Exec offers comprehensive, done-with-you support, guiding you every step of the way until you sign a job offer you're thrilled with. You not only master the technical skills needed for these roles, but also receive step-by-step guidance on resume development, effective job hunting, interview preparation, and offer negotiation. Everything you need to be highly successful in 2025. If you're seeking a guided process to achieve your career goals, this community is for you. Find them at school.com/CloudTechExec, and don't forget to mention that Textual Chatter sent you.
Cool. You know what's funny? Now when I look at your build, I can see Wrestler.
Yeah, I had cauliflower ear in this ear. I don't know if anybody is familiar with wrestling, but I ended up draining this ear, and then I got the nose scar, the eye. Like, it was a lot going on at that time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, as a kid, I liked to wrestle with my dad. We moved the tables up back, and me and my cousins, we would always wrestle. I was pretty decent to be like untrained, but when I got to high school, I didn't want to wrestle because for some reason I did not like the wrestling coach named Coach Moss.
Yeah.
And he's a funny guy. He talked like this. He didn't know I was a senior at the time. He seen me one day in the lunchroom. And because around that time, that's probably like the best shape I've probably ever been in since I was young.
Yeah.
I could eat anything I want, super strong. He was like, hey, boy, you want to wrestle? That's how he talked. I was like, I'm about to graduate. He was like, okay. Because one of the guys, he's been on the show. His name is Jerry. Jerry was a really good wrestler for the school. Him and this other guy, all us played football too. But I was like, I just wanted to do it, but I was like, I don't know if I want to do it. And I ain't going to lie, I didn't feel like doing the stuff where they had to do, because I know you had weight divisions, making the weight, and he had them running all different types of crazy ways and all the other stuff. So I was like,
it was tough. It was tough. But I will say that experience from like high school and college definitely like gave me the mindset to persevere through different things. I remember like one time, I was in college. I forgot what had happened, dude. I don't even remember. I think I had just got hurt or something. It wasn't like an injury, but it was like really bad pain. And then I remember like our wrestling coach at the time for the university. He was like, "Hey, no one cares." That, I mean, there wasn't really much else to be said after right. that. It's like no one actually cares. Like at this point. And then literally it was just those three words. And I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. Like, when you get out here in the real world, no one will care. Yeah. No one will care. You'll be blessed and you should be grateful if you even have one parent that actually loves and cares about the struggles that you have. Because when you get out here, it's like that. Companies are going to chew and spit you out. People are going to chew and spit you out. And you have to understand that you're going to have to figure it out on your own.
Yeah, for sure. And when you said no one cares, I just thought about, I want to say Kurt Angle won his gold medal with a broken neck.
Yeah, actually. Kurt Angle was like, when I was younger, I was like, I thought Kurt Angle was like just a funny guy until I actually did research. Let's see,
because you're younger than me. So you came in probably meeting Perk Angle.
Oh, yeah, Perk Angle. Because Perk Angle was that guy, but I just thought he was weird. I was like, wow, his character's so weird until like I actually like really was wrestling. I was like, oh, he was like that for years.
Yeah.
He just happened to make it big in wrestling.
Yeah. And then I was introduced to him as the Olympic gold medal winner drinking milk.
Yeah.
At WWF, like when I was still WWF. So that's how I was introduced to Kurt Angle back when he had the hair and him. And it was Dean Malenko, Bret Hart, Chris Benoit. Like, I used to like
the golden era of wrestling.
Yeah. They probably still do now, but now that I'm older, I don't even know where to start, like with the storyline. So I'm so lost. Like when people like, yeah, you seen? I was like, I don't know what's going on, bro. I stopped watching in about 2004, 2005 because I got down once I really found out it wasn't real.
Yeah, so yeah.
It took away from the mystique for me.
Like some people like Sting, the what's it called, the Dudley Brothers.
Yeah, Dudley Boys. You got Edge and Christian, the Hardy Boys.
Triple H. That was the fire time, man. I don't necessarily know anything about the current characters now, but like, those have like imprints on me that I will never forget.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I thought like before, like I wanted to be an architect, I thought I was going to grow up. I used to work on like maybe trying to cut some promos. I was going to go to wrestling school and be out there and wrestle. I was like, man, most of them dudes are ex-athletes.
Yeah. They're, you know how much athleticism it takes to do that? Yeah. Like it, yeah, they're actually like that.
Like 7-footers doing some crazy stuff. Yeah, it's
like
stuff,
actually backflips. Like, what? Yeah.
I was like, but I don't know. But it seemed like at one point in time, everybody got to get on the juice.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that either.
Triple H came back jacked.
And The Rock has been jacked since the start of his career. And now he's getting like the heart thing going on. It's like, all right, bro, you can stop lying about it now.
Yeah, I saw somebody say that on TikTok. I think it's that too. I think, I don't know if he's juicing now. He may be like on some really good supplements and some stuff that may have some bad side effects
potentially,
because I mean he's
always been big and lean.
He's since getting close to 60.
Yeah,
well, no, when he first started, you can definitely tell he used to play like DN because he wasn't as defined.
I remember him, he was on that football podcast and they were like, he was a D1 athlete at the state of Florida or something. Yeah, but he ended up getting injured. And then that's where he transitioned to wrestling. And then from there, I'm assuming that's when he really started.
Yeah, when
like
I met him, he wasn't as cut and defined. Yeah. He was 6'4", 6'5", 260s or something like that.
But
he
then it's like, dude, you're about to be 60. Like, what is the point?
Yeah, he probably still want to do movies and stuff, you know?
I guess. I want to understand until I get to that level. But like, I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, he should just try to relax and just be in as good a shape as Shannon Sharp.
Yeah.
That's like, that's what he should be. Like,
better than the vast majority better of 60-year-olds.
Better than me. Like, I go work out when I can, but shoot, with life and little kids and doing multiple hats, it gets tough. But I try to do like 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I try to do my weights and then do like the steady state cardio like right after that.
Same.
Just easier. And if I do run, I like to run outside. I don't like run on treadmill.
I hear you. Like even now, like with no kids, but just like the busyness of life, I'm like, dang, like sometimes going to the gym is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like, oh my God. But
dude, half the battle is, that's the funny thing. A lot of people that aren't gym goers don't know that half the battle was just getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause once you're there, you're going to make use of the time. But like, man, like there's some days where it's 5 o'clock. I know I'm done with work and I'm just like, oh, bro, I could go take a nap right now.
I prefer to go before work.
If I did that at one point, but it would, I would still be busy at night. So it's like if I don't fall asleep immediately at like 11 or 12 and then I turn around to get up at 5, I'm going to be cooked. I wouldn't like be as I wouldn't have enough sleep for me to have like a
session. The brief time I was waking up at like maybe like 4:30 to get there for 5.
Yeah.
I was going to sleep at like 10 cuz I work at midshift. Yeah. So I was, you know, eating at whatever time and then I was going to bed early.
Yeah.
And then that worked cuz I was energized for the day cuz for me, even though I work at midshift, I don't really sleep in because I'm still getting up with the kids in the morning. So it's just like, might as well do something where I go to sleep because a lot of times I'm up to like 1 or 2. And I'm either doing some work or I try to step away from the computer and just not look at it and do something else that will probably look at the screen just to unwind. But yeah. But to the segue back into like the tech talk. So you said you got the first awesome opportunity. What type of job were you doing at that role?
Cloud, surprisingly enough, but it was very low level, like very, I would say not low level, but there was still automation, there was still Terraform, but it was very much like getting my feet wet there. I did get exposed to like Microsoft Azure, get my first certification, but that just transitioned off of like a relationship that I had with someone at the company. And then from there, like, I wanted to understand what the differences was between the cloud service providers. Because they're, like, a big three for a reason, but it's 1, 2, and 3. Not all three push prominently at the same time. So, once I did get exposed to Azure, I'd get opportunities that was like, well, okay, well, we want somebody to learn AWS. So, I was like, all right, cool. Well, let me go learn AWS. And then I get other opportunities, and they'd be like, well, we want someone that knows GCP. All right, well, let me go learn GCP, too. So, like, in my desire to learn the differences between the cloud platforms, I also had a desire to get a particular kind of rejection for opportunities. Like, certain certifications, for sure, once you have actually done them, your level or understanding of the platform has a particular floor. And I didn't, more or less, I pursued certifications that guaranteed that if you interview me, I know what I'm talking about. And I didn't want to ever go to an interview again and be like, oh, well, you don't know enough about this cloud platform. Like, so then my interview rejection started to turn from, it's not that you don't know about the platform, we just wanted more experience. So that was more or less what got me to this point, just pursuing like a particular kind of no.
When you say a particular kind of no, what's the no? Like, oh, we decided to go internal?
The no's that I was pursuing was we wanted more experience or the direct no's. Like, I prefer when a company just tells you straight up, hey, we didn't like you, or we wanted someone with more experience. Those are the best kind of no's in my opinion, because it's not open-ended and you don't really have to think too much about what you could do to improve. But to me, the worst kinds of no's are when you just get the email, the recruiter doesn't follow up with you, the company doesn't follow up with you, because then it's like, yeah, I get it, nobody cares, nobody will ever care about your desire to improve, but considering I just invested maybe 2 or 3 hours in your awful process, the least you could do is give me something to improve on, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing I wanted to know one time. It was crazy, bro. I had interview for this job. I knocked my assessment out the park because they gave me like a IR scenario to do. Knocked out the park. And I got to do my sprint, but I didn't get picked after the sprint.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking, because I record everything, and I was like, I couldn't have did bad.
Right.
I know when something sounds bad. And so I saw that the role either opened up again, or maybe there's an additional one. And so I was reaching out to the recruiter at that time, just to come to find out the next day, he was announcing he got laid off. Because I was going to ask him on LinkedIn. I said, hey, I know you probably couldn't say nothing on your company's email, but I want to know, like, hey, what did the notes actually say? Because I'm always perplexed about some things. I know when I listen to something, like, yeah, I wasn't that strong right there, but I gave it a shot. It's probably why they ain't going with me. Versus maybe I just want the person they wanted. Because I know I was interviewing with a person who particularly wasn't the person that pulled my resume or anything at the time. Mm-hmm. So maybe he didn't want me to be on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I, on the topic of that, like, I had an interview recently. Mind you, clearly, I have this recorded. And matter of fact, I posted it on TikTok, actually. The recruiter had called me back and he was like, yeah, it wasn't that you didn't have the technical understanding or the experience. It was that you were too locked in. He said that they didn't want to move forward with you because you were too locked in. That was the exact words from the recruiter verbatim. Like, bro, just tell me you don't like me. Like, that's totally
what does
cool.
that mean? Too yeah, locked in?
Exactly. What does that mean? Exactly. I don't know. I mean, I have my assessment of them. Like, I thought he was just a military guy that was relatively intimidated by the fact that I don't know. It seemed like he had a horde of engineers underneath him with a rather timid or unconfident personality. And then he also did mixed martial arts as well, too. And then when I told him, oh, yeah, I do mixed martial arts, too, and I don't really, you know, it seemed like he wanted someone who
was... Gonna clash, maybe?
Potentially, for sure. But what was he? He was like a jiu-jitsu blue belt. If anybody is watching this that does jiu-jitsu, if you run into somebody who actually wrestles, your blue belt doesn't really mean anything. And I kind of did say that in the interview as well,
bro,
too.
That's what we need to do, bro.
Yeah, that would be fire.
I've always wanted to, without getting hurt, I've always wanted to see how long would I last against, like, a legitimate, like, wrestler. Like, I always wanted to see, like, how, you know, what I would do, whatever. Like, I know different things, like, about leverage and shifting this. But, I mean, of course, I don't know all the little technical cool stuff that y'all know. But I always want to see. I feel like the average person, if I was to wrestle them, I'd kill them.
Yeah, average people. Yeah, if you're, like, a NARP, like a non-athletic regular person, anybody who's just a little bit athletic would probably, like, squash you. But, I mean, if you're, like, a non-athletic regular person going up against somebody who wrestled at a collegiate level would probably have the worst day of their life, mm-hmm. for sure.
I think they only got a chance if weight classes don't matter. Meaning that if on their lucky day, they were able to get it to where you could not spin out of their lock.
Maybe.
That's what I'm saying. On their lucky day.
On a lucky day, you might get lucky.
No, I'm like, think about it. Because, like, let's say you ran against a decent athletic person that is, I know you're strong. I've seen you work out. But the hard thing, even with being strong, is still compensating for
the strength,
the X amount of, like, body weight. So if you're going against a guy that may be
like 300. Yeah, 300. Yeah, that's natural. That's size and athleticism.
Yeah.
That might be a problem.
Yeah, because, like, I remember this time when I was a kid, my uncle, he's about 6'1", whatever. And G2, I want to say G2 may be shorter than me at the time. And he was taller than us because we was kids. But he was strong.
Yeah.
But as strong as he was, he really couldn't do much with my uncle because my uncle was as strong or stronger than him.
Yeah.
And Abe was like, yeah, it's like, big. It's not nothing that you can do. You got to overcome this. And that's the same thing that happens when people are, whether it comes to wrestling, where you're playing basketball, something like that. You look at somebody, yeah, I'm strong at my size, but I'm not going to stop a 6'10 guy from posting me.
Yeah.
I just can't stop.
It's not going to happen. Like the people in the NFL, those are actually like freaks of nature. Like, even regardless of what they do, they're going to be a problem to deal with.
Imagine having to wrestle Aaron Donald.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely not. No.
But back to the cloud stuff.
Yeah.
So you said you got your first taste of doing Azure. So when you got your first Azure cert, was it the AZ900?
Yeah. That certification, I have like a certification pathway as well for like that I've built out based on my experience for people who are thinking about getting into the space. The Azure 900 is a certification that you could just pick up without any prior knowledge to the cloud space. So, and also it's a very mature certification, meaning mature in the sense of it's coming from a very respected platform, Microsoft. And also the content associated with it has been around for such a long time that you can find really good resources for it, right? You could literally go on YouTube, type in Azure for everyone, watch that entire video series, take a practice exam, and then get that certification in like 7 to 10 days. It's a very good certification in my opinion, but that's not going to be enough for you to really get into the space. That only happened for me personally because as I was studying, I already had like a computer science background. I could already build my first application. Me learning the things from that certification allowed me to still build very robust projects with the knowledge that I got from it. And mind you, that cert really just teaches you what the cloud is.
And the services.
And the services for the Microsoft Azure platform. With that knowledge and my background, like I could literally just go and actually build out an environment at that point. Just from reading the documentation and the little bit of knowledge I had from that. And that was enough for me personally. But I was the type of person who's been playing video games, building computers, breaking computers for like years before that, you know?
Yeah. I know I always tell people about the AZ900 or the cloud practitioner, and I figure what the GCP's joint is. But I was like,
they didn't even got one.
They do. They got one.
What, the digital leader?
I don't know. It's very entry level. And I only noticed because one of my very first clients back in 20, was that late 2020 or 2021? I'm about to text her and ask her. But she went and got like all three because she was trying to go into the cloud at the time.
I didn't even know they had an entry one. That's what you're saying.
I like the cloud search opposed to the security search because the cloud search actually if you get the right type of course, like I have for my stuff for AWS and Azure, these guys on Udemy, Stefan Merrick
and
it's another guy. I forgot what the other guy's name is, but they're on my Udemy. And these are the people I use for the courses at the time. And you know, they walk you through, okay, hey, set this up, do this, do that. That's much better than you just reading a book and highlighting stuff that you won't remember.
Oh yeah. Some people come in my like TikTok live. I forgot, somebody asked me. I was like, oh, what's the last tech book that you read? I don't read books. If you want to learn something in tech, unless it's like the CISSP or the GIOC certifications, there's no point in you reading a book, in my opinion. Like everything, there's already a well, if it's a very mature certification that is very popular in the space, there's a course somewhere that you can just consume. Like even with my mentees, like I don't tell them to buy any books. Don't buy any branded books. If you're studying AWS, don't buy any AWS books. Don't buy any CompTIA books. Go and just watch a course on YouTube or Udemy for it because it's more efficient. Like, nah, nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you get your skills up with the cloud stuff, what was the next step for you to where you finally got a role that you said was a little bit more challenging?
The next steps at that point for me was interview skills. Like, I might be misunderstanding your question. After I got skilled up, what was it?
Well, I remember you said your first role was like the opportunity you had was right. Like, you know, it wasn't as challenging. But I was talking about like, I say maybe their first role was like more entry level.
Yeah.
And I was saying like, what was your next, I guess, like mid to senior level role that like you did? And then that was like more challenging for you. And then you got to do like different things on that job that kind of pretty much led to where you are now.
Yeah, I would say the roles that are more customer facing, and the roles that deal with multiple different brands or teams within the overall organization. Because the fact that you're forced to be more customer facing means you have to be more finite with the language that you use and show a deeper understanding of the technology or solution that you're trying to provide to the org. So I think when I did jump to another opportunity, that it forced me to be that way. And I didn't like it, but ultimately it made me better technically. It made me better in the workplace. And then it also made me better in the interview space as well too. But the reason for wanting to hop was just money. I mean, I was confident in my skill set. At that point, I think I had a lot of certifications at that point. I got my AZ-900 and then I went back to get my Security Plus. Then I got my 104, my 305. Then I got my Solutions Architect Associate, Solutions Architect Professional. And then I turned, And then I turned around to get my Google Cloud Associate and then my Google Cloud Professional. And then everything after that was just like icing on the cake. And I didn't even need all those certs. Mm-hmm. I just got them because I wanted a particular type of interview rejection. But like, after that, it was like, yeah, I know what I'm talking about. Like, I will never, ever go to a cloud interview and then have someone be like, oh, you don't really know enough. No, I know enough. My floor is stable for sure. At that point, it was like, I'm chasing more income and I wanted more income. And I knew that I had the skills to get it. I just had to make sure that I could cultivate the opportunities for it.
Okay. Cool. Now, to get into some more specific questions. Well, first off, I want to ask about, how did you end up getting into DevOps?
I think it's just a nature of learning the cloud. Like there's, in 2025, I think the vast majority of companies are misnaming a lot of the roles that they have available. There are companies that'll call roles cloud engineer or cloud support or cloud operations, when in all actuality, they want a DevOps engineer. They want a cloud engineer who knows how to automate all the processes, systems, and deployments from a cloud perspective. But getting into DevOps, I think, is like the next logical step if you're in the cloud space and you don't niche down. Like there's cloud network engineers, there's cloud security engineers, cloud DevOps engineers. I think when you do have a really strong foundation for cloud, naturally companies will try to grab you and put you in that DevOps space, because a lot of the teams that are migrating over to a cloud space or just learning the cloud, they don't really know that stuff. They're working within some type of framework and constraints that they don't really like, with a lack of experience, like a bank. I don't know if any of y'all worked from banks or have worked with banks before. It's either a shit show or things are moving too fast for them to actually really handle. And those are the environments where you'll see development teams migrating over to a platform and they don't know how the cloud works at all. They just know that they're going to have another database on the platform. It's very, and that's where the DevOps engineers come in. It's like you want to empower the teams to be able to deploy themselves or work with it. And it's just like a lot sometimes.
For sure. So let me ask you one of these. I think this is a good one. Given your experience with AWS, Azure, and GCP, how do you typically approach choosing the right cloud provider for a specific project or client need? And are there common scenarios where one excels over the other?
Yeah. I feel like I've gotten this at an interview before. You probably have. But I always tell them, the first thing is your relationship with the platform that you're choosing. Do you have a partnership with the company? And then what are your constraints on budget? Does your leadership or organization value cost efficiency, or do they value the relationship that they have with them? If you're thinking about moving or migrating over to the cloud, Azure, AWS, GCP, whatever, and you only have one platform with one deal, you're probably going to go with that platform. But if you have two platforms or three platforms with competing rates at which they'll give you a discount for migrating over X amount of data or X amount of years worth of services to their platform, chances are you may go with that one, right? So if an org told me, hey, like, which one would you choose? Whoever gives you the best deal is probably what I would start with. And then secondly, I would think about what's the actual workload you're moving over there? Is it something that you're going to try to convert over to microservices? Is it just that you're about to move data over there for data analysis? Like, are you trying to have some type of serverless type of deal? Then I would consider the use case. But first, budget, relationship, and then use case. Like, in that order, to me personally.
Bet, yeah. These definitely some good interview questions. So, this is the follow-up.
Yeah.
Many organizations struggle with multi-cloud strategies. From your perspective, what are the biggest benefits and challenges of operating across multiple cloud environments?
Benefits. I personally don't think it's that big of a benefit for operating in a multi-cloud environment, unless, once again, it's related to budget. I don't think it's that big of a benefit when you're considering between Azure and AWS. I think those two are front runners for a reason. The services that they have across the platforms are comparable. The cost efficiency might be different depending on the platform. But I've really only ever seen companies say, hey, I want to move to GCP because they want to do some data analytics, some database stuff, or use BigQuery to pull in something, right? That's the only use case that I've seen consistently over the last several years. For Azure and AWS, people use that for whatever. But I don't think there's like a huge benefit for multi-cloud unless there's a specific service on each platform that you want to use or you have internal skills with. Like, and when I say internal skills, I mean you have people or engineers within your org that can maximize the tool that you're trying to use. And then also, if you just say, hey, I'm going to go all in and use multi-cloud, you're probably going to have to invest in engineers with that external skill set to manage on that cloud platform. So it's like the use case has to make sense to me. But personally, like, no, I don't think it's that efficient unless you're like, I absolutely have to use Lambda with BigQuery. Like, bro, I'm going to look at you and I'm going to be like, probably not.
Okay. So, yeah, you're saying as them using multi-cloud as in like together.
Yeah.
And I know I view it as each cloud doing their own thing in the environment. That's how I kind of.
Yeah. And then I'm like, well, then it depends on what the own thing is. Like, is it that you're just migrating data? Is it that you're migrating virtual machines? Or is it that you're migrating like some type of serverless or microservice architecture? Like, what is the thing that you need from the platform? And why can't you just do it all on one? Like, give me a succinct reason why you can't just put Kubernetes on there or something.
That's a good one. I think because a lot of companies probably eventually first went to AWS, but then they had all this old Microsoft stuff that they was using, mm-hmm. which inevitably turned into, on the back end, being Azure.
Makes sense.
O365, SharePoint, all AD, all this different stuff is probably just still Azure-based. And then, like I said, I don't know what they're using GCP for. They're using it. But then that comes into play when companies now are getting, well, you had Prisma, that was the big dog, but now Wiz has kind of kicked them over. And so that's where I see that shining too, where, like you said, did you ever figure out, like, I remember we were talking about Wiz, what was it, a month or two ago?
Yeah.
About, did you ever get your hands on it?
On the Wiz certification, no. If anybody's watching, I would definitely get my hands on a Wiz certification. At this point, I want to learn Splunk. I want to learn Splunk, so I'm going to learn Splunk right now, but like, if anybody's watching, I would get a Wiz certification. It's a very valid, very prominently used tool at this point. I would pick it up. But not at this moment.
Yeah, I'm thinking, because it was one of the things I brought up in the one-on-one of like seeing if we was partners to get some more material and get the certification. So that's something I'm actually waiting on, because I'm trying to see if their certs are like CrowdStrike. So like a lot of CrowdStrike stuff, CrowdStrike University, and you got to do it through them versus those things that's not gatekept, like the AWS or Amazon and Microsoft and all those, where you can go set all the stuff up and whatever, which is why I always tend to lean more towards people going Azure route in a sense, like especially for like security operations. I was like, bet instead of you setting up Elastic or something, go ahead and go set up Sentinel.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing companies move to Sentinel. And then with Azure, they'll let you use Defender for a trial. They'll let you use all these different things. So now on your resume, you can say, I know how to use Sentinel. I know how to use Defender. I know how to use Threat Explorer. I know how to use all this stuff. So you can technically go niche down and find roles that's only using Microsoft stuff.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to learn in 2025. There's a lot of tools that require you to have a relationship with the platform for you to get a community version of it. For instance, CrowdStrike. They require you to have a business email. Mm-hmm. I have a business email, and I did try to get access to CrowdStrike community or the trial version of it. But the point is, you have to go through all of these loopholes for you to get access to a tool that companies ask you to have experience with for you to get a job. And I don't like that practice. Like, if you want a tool to be prominently known across the industry, it shouldn't be gatekept to people already in the industry. That's not how you raise the floor for skill, in my opinion.
I agree.
Like your Splunk, your Tenable, Nessus, you could just go grab those. You could just go pull them down, right? Your Terraform, your Azure AWS, you could just go grab that stuff and learn it yourself. And I think that's the beauty of the space. But these other more specific security tools, sometimes like it's just you got to work there to deal with it sometimes.
Yeah. And that's when people online would tell us like, hey, no, y'all gatekeeping. Like, no.
We can't. We literally can't share it with you. Or we're going to lose our job if we do the screen recording.
The real gatekeeping is what we're talking about, where you can only access stuff if you work somewhere. And that's what I was like, when we were talking earlier about the answer you gave is only something you will know with experience.
Exactly.
And just one of those things, like some of the stuff that CrowdStrike does, you would never know about unless you actually interacted with them, the platform. And it's why you can go get. So I remember we had to do this, like when I worked for Optiv, we had to get these. Everybody that worked in the SOC had to get the certified, what is it, CCFA, I believe, or CFA. Certified CrowdStrike Falcon Administrator. All of us had to go get that certification just for a selling point, I guess for some type of contract or something.
Yeah, like companies, though, like even for some of the certs that I do have that I do renew, sometimes the company will ask you to, for your certification credentials so that they can pair it with their organization to display within the org and with the company it's partnered with, that they have X amount of engineers certified with the platform for their relationship. It doesn't benefit you at all at being a certification holder, but like I see that a lot. Like, and sometimes I'm hesitant to give them my credentials. Like, why? What am I going to get for this? I'm the one who took the exam. Like, y'all better throw me some bread or something. Like, I don't like that either.
Yeah, for sure. And I just thought about something else. CrowdStrike also has their own SIEM solution now.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So that's something else you can't just learn unless you already got access to CrowdStrike. It's called, I want to say it's Raptor.
Raptor?
I think it's Raptor. Because their search language used to be very similar to SPL.
So it's like SPL is for Splunk?
It used to be just like, pretty much.
Okay, because to me, at this point, I think like KQL, SPL, whatever, they're all the same.
Similar, yeah.
They're all the same.
KQL and SQL for sure are pretty much the same.
Yeah, because I got a homeboy that does, he more or less uses KQL and Log Analytics Workspace with their like Defender, Sentinel, whatever. I was like, okay, I could do that too.
Hmm. That's a good one. Are there specific services or features within each cloud provider that you find particularly innovative or impactful for DevOps practices?
Innovative or impactful for certain DevOps processes for every cloud platform? Yeah, Azure DevOps is definitely one. Azure DevOps is a platform that I've seen used across different cloud service providers. Like I've seen it on Azure and AWS. And I have also seen it with GCP, right? That's one of the more prominent services that I was like, if somebody in 2025, he was like, what should I learn for a pipeline, repository, and automation solution? I would tell someone to pick up Azure DevOps. That's like one of the tools. On the AWS side, I'm thinking, I don't really think I've worked with an AWS tool that's just prominently used across the platforms, to be honest. GCP, hell no, they ain't got nothing like that. Unless it's like BigQuery or something, storage transfer service. But I think Azure DevOps is like the one thing. I can't think of an Azure AWS tool that's like that, at least at this moment.
Cool. Let me see. I think this was a cool one that I just looked at. Okay. Security is paramount in the cloud. What are some of the most critical security considerations you address when designing and automating cloud environments?
Policy. I think there should be more focus on the policy or policy as code once an environment is stood up. Like, it's easy for you to stand up a whole environment with Terraform and a pipeline solution of whatever, but I think that should be a focus to automatically or at least set the policy packs. And Microsoft is really good about having like a pre-built out policy set for you that you could just click and apply to the environments. But I think that's something that I would consider heavily. And then also privileged identity management. Like, I think everyone should have to elevate to do anything in any environment in the portal. I think that's something to consider too. But for me personally, that's what I would consider. And like, I'm saying automate and build out an environment. And what I mean by that is like the actual full thing, the management groups, the subscription, the architecture. Mm-hmm. I think that is easier to do than actually make sure that all of the security principles are in place. And when I say do, I mean the networking, the routing, that's not like crazy to do, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had to do these freaking joint AWS days to do like these specific trainings. I know one of the labs is walking through and I see this, like I said, on the back end all the time when I'm reviewing logs of assumed roles and these roles shouldn't be able to do certain things. I mean, well, the other experience thing, right? Think about it. We was talking about how people want to forego doing help desk to jump to the SOC role and don't even understand.
I am.
What's a service account?
Yeah.
What a service account should and shouldn't be doing.
Those things are a big deal. Like, I'm not an identity and access management analyst or engineer or whatever, but that is inherently part of my day-to-day because of working in a cloud environment. Like, a lot of the concepts or a lot of the things that you would learn from, quote-unquote, cybersecurity certifications, you have to understand those at a fundamental level for you to be successful in the cloud.
Like, no, for sure.
And if you're just skipping help desk and going straight to it, it might not be the most ideal for you.
That's, you know, and I actually just thought about that. Like I said, I did help desk, 11 years ago? Back when, technically on a government network, cloud was nothing back then. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was something on maybe private side, but back then in 2014, it was all on-prem stuff. So I'm wondering how help desk looks now that more cloud stuff is involved.
I guess you can tell me
from the most interview advice you got.
Yeah, I haven't had like a mentee recently sign at the help desk to be able to tell me. And then when I interact with help desk now, I honestly wouldn't say things have changed. It's still hello, this is so-and-so for so-and-so company. Could you please give me your company ID? And then they walk through it or whatever. I don't see a lot of companies or a lot of prominent companies fully automating that process. I know there's like, I forgot his name on TikTok, but he's pretty big in the AWS space for talking about AWS cloud. A lot of companies want to try to abstract and remove their help desk entirely by using AI agents. Banks, not happening. I don't think that's happening with
them. I'm glad you said that because the other day I was researching. I'm always researching, and this is going to segue into our next segment that I was talking about before. I'm always researching different ways to wow the interviewers.
Yeah.
And so I was researching agentic AI agents for sock analyst mm-hmm. and found out, like, you know, that's the whole niche of people promising, hey, it could do all this stuff fast and help out, which I have to actually see it to believe it.
Yeah, because Simone had made like a, I think she was on Tech Jobbers podcast. Shout out to Tech Jobbers podcast. I'm going to be on there eventually. She had made a statement that was of like someone that she knew who has a company that is.
I need to talk about Marcus Hutchins.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Marcus Hutchins. His name, I follow him on Twitter.
Yeah.
Marcus Carey.
Yeah, of having a SOC analyst agent that's already like can doing that does everything. Mm-hmm. I think if it already exists, sure. But to me, from my perspective, I think AI at this point doesn't have the full business context for it to truly abstract away the person at this point. Like,
it's this guy right here.
That's fire.
Yeah, it's this dude.
I mean, if he's already making millions doing it, by all means, but I still don't think that, like, in the present tense, you can entirely remove a person and have, like, the same quality and success at this point, just because it doesn't have all the business context.
Yeah.
And I don't see banks, and I don't see the U.S. government just giving them all of that context for the sake of an AI agent at this point. I don't think so.
I can see it as a helper. Like, of course, we got a lot of automation, but if I need some, right. like... drafting up an email, or I tell the AI, hey, we found out, you know, or doing search commands, hey, go do this Splunk query and look for this in the environment and print me a list out back, and then telling it, okay, from all this list, filter go contain these hosts. Exactly. I can see it doing that. I can't see it doing too much analysis on stuff that's not on the web. Like a person would have to deduce based on their experience what they say, okay. Yeah, because a lot of times, like, the newbies, when they want to come in the SOC, their first go-to is, okay, I took this hash and I threw it in a virus total, so it's clean. I don't necessarily mean it's clean just because that. Mm-hmm. I wonder, and they probably can't do this, AI agents, are they detonating the file, the malware, and then going through and kind of, like, examining it, or are they just taking the results and going off of whatever happened in the detonation to say it's good or bad? Like, all these things are pretty interesting to me, and I probably would love... If there's any AI companies out there you want to come on the show, let's talk about it.
I'm interested because I'm not knocking it. Like, she also did make a statement that, like, DevOps roles could be automated as well too. And honestly, I'm also gonna give us as a cloud security engineer, I disagree with that statement because the complexity of certain DevOps roles, it's just not there yet. Like even in my day to day now, there's stuff that I'll experience that I won't know, and I would never know because I wasn't there when it was built first, and everything is cloud native anyway, so the complexity of it is crazy. I mentioned Azure DevOps before. This is like a full Azure environment with all of the cloud offerings and Azure DevOps to manage all the deployments for the Kubernetes clusters, operations, all the IaaS services managed there. And it's just so, it's like a bowl of spaghetti, but every single noodle is a different noodle. Does that make, like just think about that. And I don't perceive, at least right now, that we could just have full automation for DevOps roles like that. Just not right now. I don't think so. It's just not enough business context, I feel.
Yeah, and that's one of the things AI lacks is context. Now, for a fun segment, interviews. Mm-hmm. What are the companies getting wrong with the interviews? My last week's episode... We talked about my guy, what's his name? I keep on messing his name up. Mm-hmm. Sacram or whatever his name is. No, not him. Not the podcast guy. The guy, the Indian guy that's working at all the YC companies. He had like eight or some jobs. Whatever. But he kept on getting hired. But we were talking about like the brokenness in the job search process. And that one or two things sometimes happens. For me, it's either interviewers know what they talk about, or they don't know, or they don't know how to even just scope talent correctly. Yeah. What's going on with it, in your opinion?
So first of all, and this is coming from somebody who interviews regularly because I want to stay sharp. It starts at the talent acquisition place first. I was talking to, and for some of you who may be familiar with me and my content, I post my interview experiences because I want to document. I want you guys to see what's going on. It starts at talent acquisition because these U.S. companies are outsourcing their talent acquisition to overseas teams. So what does that look like exactly? It looks like Deborah in HR paying Sanjeev halfway across the world to send, to call you and go through a script and then ask you to send them an email with your information, name, location, zip, phone number, email, first four of your social, things like that, right? You submit the information. And then also this guy who they hired in India, he can't even read in the first place. All right, so it starts there. They're hiring people to save money and outsource their labor, but they're hiring incompetent people. So you're already pushing talent away. If you were someone with a true six-figure skill set in the tech space and you get a call at 3:24 p.m. Eastern from someone in India, are you even going to think that's a legitimate person calling you for a job opportunity? No. And a lot of people don't know that these are legitimate opportunities for the first thing. And then, like, the second thing is that companies don't even know what they want. Like, Fiserv hit me the other day. I don't care to name drop them because they literally told me. One, Fiserv didn't call me directly. Once again, their hired help overseas is who called me first. So the overseas people source you, and then they submit you to the third-party company in the U.S. So just to make sure you understand, a third-party Indian team will call you, and then they'll forward you to a third-party team on U.S. soil, and that third-party team will forward you to the direct company that they actually want you to interview for, right? So Fiserv is hiring a third-party in the U.S. That third-party in the U.S. is hiring an Indian third-party company, right? So you're already going through three sets of people for you to get one interview, right? And this is Fiserv, by the way. This company who you – I'm pretty sure you guys know who Fiserv is, who's giant, right? So they hit me to do a technical assessment for the third-party company, the U.S.-based one. This guy asked me to deploy a Kubernetes cluster. I do it in like 3 minutes. And then like, mind you, this is a screen share. I do it in like 3 minutes with Terraform. And then he goes, is it up? I'm like, yeah. Like, can you look at my screen? Like, you could clearly see it says deployed. We're looking at it together in the portal. But I say that to say they have you go through these technical screenings with people who don't necessarily know what to look for. And then, you know, we turn it over after the technical assessment is done. They ask me, well, do you have any questions for us? My first question, and I always ask this question, Peep Game, if you guys are doing interviews, I always ask this question. What does the day-to-day for this opportunity look like? I ask that question first. Guess what they tell me?
I don't know.
They tell me I don't know. So I ask them, okay, well, like, is this a new team? Yeah, it's a brand new team. Okay, so you don't know what you're looking for. Do you know, like, what the headcount is? We're looking to hire about 15 engineers. Do you know what they'll be doing? No. It's for a digital team. Digital meaning cloud. So they pass you through two sets of third-party entities to find you, to screen you in an inefficient way, and then also to tell you that we don't know what you're hiring you for. This is just one company. And Nike also does the same thing, by the way, right? So I'm just name-dropping these companies because I don't care to work with them necessarily because their process just sounds like they're trying to cut corners to save budget but also pushing away other talent. And I'm skilled. I'm actually like that. Like, I'm on this podcast because I'm like that. I'm actually skilled. But there's other people who are more skilled than me who I'm sure have passed up opportunities like that because I'm not going to pick up my phone at 3:24 to talk to Sanjeev in India. Like,
yeah. Like, funny enough, I can actually show you. Dang it. My other phone is right there.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'll show you my Discord right now. One of my clients, his dad, like, hey, my son got reached out to by these such and such recruiters. Look, let me see. You can scroll down and you can see like this real time. This happened yesterday.
Yeah.
Both for the same role, but it seemed odd to me. It seemed very easy. It's like a front end dev role. And then I looked at the requirements. I was like, it don't seem hard.
Right.
Stuff like that seemed a little sketchy to me. Cause like.
No. And the thing about it is these are legitimate opportunities. Because they're coming from overseas, because they're coming from weird times a day, and because they're always pushy and rushing you to get your information, you think it's not real. And the reason that they do that is because the U.S. company, they are giving them a bonus for getting you hired. And right, so naturally they hire these Indian teams and pay them rupees, which is the Indian currency. Mm-hmm. But if they get you hired, they get a 500 plus bonus in U.S. dollars. Right. So they're super pushy on the phone. They send you these half baked job descriptions, right, to get you through the process. And it just scares away U.S. talent.
Yeah. Because I think in the past, so many people have been burned by them. Like, they hit me all the time on the podcast, say, I don't really care for it too much. So, like, because anytime I tried to send my stuff to them or something, I never heard of it back. So I was like, are y'all stealing my resume and stuff and sending it around? And that's why I'm getting all these phone calls. Mm-hmm. Did I actually get denied? Like, It's a lot of stuff to where I, like you said, I just fuck on, I just work somebody American.
Yeah, and then, I don't know. And then on the American side, where it's just like fully, on the American side, where it's fully on seas recruiters, it'll still be third-party recruiting because a lot of companies, like, they just have a hard time finding some of the talent. But they're using a third-party recruiter because they can't find it internally for several reasons. Either it's a brand new role and they're not paying enough, they're not asking for the right requirements, mm-hmm. or they have like this weird internal thing going on. And like what I'm seeing is that companies that are using American HR staff, they're trying to fill roles that they're underpaying for, that they want you to be in the office for. Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you, it's like, okay, you want me in the office 3 to 5 days a week, potentially, but the pay doesn't align with that. And yeah. then like, who was it? What was that company? What's that burger company? Shake Shack. They're building a new spot. They called me for, and they were like, "No. I can name drop like a million companies name right now that just
we got like Cam Newton said, we keep it funky."
And what's it? Okay, I'm not even gonna go with Shake Shack. I'm gonna go with somebody else. The company who does like all the financing for what are they called? Cadillac or something? Whatever. They're like a bank or something. They wanted to hire someone, a U.S. DevOps engineer, to come in and work 5 days a week in the office. Cool. The pay didn't line up, first of all. That was the one thing. But then I asked them, like, okay, well, what's their current team like? Like, what's the team size currently? Like, oh, you know, we have a offshore team. Right. So they're hiring this new U.S. guy to come.
Trying to manage those people.
And fix everything. Because clearly, you already know how Indian teams operate. It's usually very low-quality work for low-quality pay, of course. Who would have thought, right? Mm-hmm. But they're hiring this U.S. guy to come in, lead the team of overseas people, i.e. hire him and to fire everybody else. But he has to be in the office 5 days a week, but you were so cool with hiring a fully remote overseas team. Like, isn't that actually moving backwards? And then you still want a higher quality of talent, too, mm-hmm. for the same money. So it's like, they want to shortchange people to have them come into the office for more skills, but they're not willing to pay or be fair about it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, like I know. Now, I'll say in this instance that I'm currently doing now, this is probably the first time I had an overseas team that's pretty good, surprisingly.
Yeah.
And it's only surprisingly because a lot of times it seems like they just be hiring anybody.
Very much so.
But that's what prompted my post with Malice mm-hmm. the other day that I posted on LinkedIn. I posted everywhere. Because that picture is funny because that's the face he make every time somebody asks him something he don't care for. But like Verizon was, they had, like I said, I posted it on my story, but they had a wide range, bro. 101 to 194. That was supposed to be like base.
Right.
Just for them to say, for Dallas, they only want people to come in 2 days a week. That's all right, cool. But they only want to pay 130.
It's like, so where's that other 50 grand? Who was getting that other 60 grand?
Right. And so they was like, well, because they go off of cost of labor, they rank Dallas as like a level 2.
So what, I got to live in Los Angeles?
It was like, you got to live in like New York or Virginia or New Jersey or something.
So then how are they going to come in 2 days a week then?
I think it was based on the different locations they had, but I was just like, I think that's stupid. Because I was like, I know cost of labor is not as cheap as it used to be, right. Especially with cost of living that's went up out here. I was like, that's like the second company that did that in telecom. T-Mobile tried to do the same thing, except they wanted people to do 4 days a week, and they wasn't paying enough for you to come in 4 days a week. It was a little bit more than that, but not enough to come in 4 days a week if you're already remote. I was just like, y'all are driving the senior talent away.
And to me, I perceive the logic of them wanting you to come in because they want you to spend money on parking, spend money in their building, invest in the campus. Like, bro, I don't want to come and eat your crappy office food. I work out. Like, I know there's people who, like, bro, I don't want to come and eat the crappy office food.
Our food was good at JP Morgan.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you see what the CEO said about remote work? Like, he was like... And it's
Jamie Dion?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've seen the recent stuff, but yeah, we did a live stream on it.
Really?
When he wanted people to return to work and stuff.
I've never met someone in real life who liked working at JP Morgan.
That's what I'm saying. I think it depends. Like I said, the Plano location.
Yeah.
You were kind of by the area.
Really?
Yeah, she stays like probably, I'm not going to say her name so people don't know where they can try to go find her, but she stays probably like 5 minutes from the Plano location.
Right.
But no, the Plano location, they had some really good food there, surprisingly.
Interesting.
And they had two cafeterias, one in like the bigger one in one building and the smaller one in the other building.
Even still, that ain't enough for me to like want to actually come into the office. Like, what's it called? On that other podcast, they were like, the leases are coming due for a lot of these buildings. And like, what is the point? If I actually don't have to work with any other hardware besides my laptop, why would I want to come in the office where I'm going to book Zoom meetings with people anyways?
And that was the whole, my issue was like, why am I in the only person in office when the rest of my team is in Columbus?
Right. Like, for what?
I was the only person that was in Plano. Like, that's why our real deal used to just go and then leave at 12 a lot of days. Or if I had an appointment or something I need to do in the city, I just would do that.
And I'm going to be honest, I feel like generally more productive at home. Because like when you actually get into that flow state of troubleshooting or engineering something, having people walk up to you or having a loud noise happen in the office really takes you out of that state. It's in my opinion. I feel like I'm way more productive at home. And then you'll get people to pull you. Hey, you want to go to lunch? Like, not really. I kind of just want to get this done. Like, not that I'm not like antisocial, but like I'm not like a people person at the same time either. I'm not.
You could have fooled me.
I like a very select few people.
Yeah. Nah. But what else I want to talk about with interviewing? Let's talk about even niching down. What are people messing up on when it comes to interviewing, in your opinion?
I think here's three things that you could do to immediately up the quality of interviewing that you can do. Here's three things that you could do to immediately up how good you perform in your tech interviews. The first thing is to ask clarifying questions. When you get a question from an interviewer, take a moment to pause and ask clarifying questions about what they're asking you. The pause is going to indicate that you're actually thinking about what's going to come out of your mouth. And also, it's going to indicate to the interviewer that you're deeply thinking about the question and you care about the responses you're going to have. So clarifying questions for sure. Second thing is, this is very overlooked. I talked about this with AD when I first met him. Have a very nice interview setup. I'm not saying go and buy a 4K camera, get you a Z EV10 and a Shure MK7, but have a clean interview setup, quiet. Because even if you perform very well technically or socially or behavioral wise, no one's going to hire someone in a dirty room with Google's Meets backdrop with stuff happening in the background. Have a clean interview setup. Have a clean mic setup. Like, I'm not saying go and invest $1,500, but you want to be clear and crisp and present yourself very well, right? So that's the second thing. And the third thing, and this is, I think, the most important thing that's going to make or break any interview. I think this is the most important thing that's going to make or break any interview that you have. Ask questions. When the interviewer turns it over to you and they say, hey, do you have any questions for me? I don't care if you have ChatGPT generated questions. You need to make sure that you have questions to ask them about the job that you could be doing, the timeline they're looking to fill the role, and interesting things related to the previous questions that they asked you in the beginning of the interview. So those three things would immediately make you a better candidate for opportunities if you implement those, for sure.
Yeah. And then I'll add in one, ask your questions based on who you're interviewing with. So if you're talking to a manager or director, try to ask more questions that they would be concerned with from a higher level versus if you're talking to an analyst or engineer, where those questions may be geared to be a little bit more technical. You want to talk about like the strategy that the company is going through, like for like, I'll ask about like security strategy. What do you guys think about implementing AI? How are you handling third-party risks? How are you handling cross-collaboration or incidents or like different things like on their metrics that they're looking at from the high level versus like what you may not be concerned with in your silo. And something simple that I've taught clients to do from day one is have like a small notebook that so you can take notes when you're interviewing, but you can also like kind of show them like, yeah, I got my numbers. I came prepared. Just showing them I'm interviewing you too.
Like I'm gonna be honest. I don't like write stuff down, but I would have a pen and I set my camera angle just above my chest. So it looks like when they're talking, I'm writing something. I don't ever write anything.
Yeah. Well, I don't write when they're talking because I'm listening because I have like I have it recording and then.
Yeah, but it's the look. The look makes them be like, okay, this guy is like really interested.
And then you can take it a step further and you can actually get your recording and use AI to break your interview down.
Oh, yeah. Have
it pull out, extrapolate questions and everything.
Absolutely.
So you can do that. And then I think it might have been one more thing I was going to bring up with the interviews that I see people messing up on. It's very simple. They don't answer what's been asked of them.
And that's where clarifying questions come in.
No, not even clarifying. They're literally just not answering. Like, the question could be simple. Hey, have you ever sat in a blue seat? Oh, one time I sat in the orange seat.
Okay, I see what you mean. Like, yeah, because if it does come down to like yes or no sometimes. Like, you could say, no, I haven't. However, I've dealt with a purple seat before, and this is how it was in comparison to blue. But yeah, you want to answer the question.
And it's also another reason to be wary of AI is I have a past client, well, a former client, and he wanted me to listen to his interviews. So he sent them to me. And so me and my guy Lee, we listened to him because he wanted our honest opinion. And I was like, to be honest, if you don't get anything back from them, it's because really in the beginning, you did not answer their questions straight up and you downplayed a lot of the stuff that they would have hired you for by oversharing. Like, he's currently not working right now. So he's working for Walmart right now in between jobs. But in the beginning, he shared like he didn't really have the experience with PowerShell, but even learning it versus just not saying it out because they didn't ask him that. Or he overshared, like they asked him, had he ever used PowerShell? And he was like, yeah, I used it. The script wasn't done by me. And I was like, yeah, you're undermining yourself when you're answering these things. I was like, so if they decide to move on from you, it's because you're just showing too much. It's like, they don't got to know how you got the script as long as you was able to make it work.
Exactly.
That's really out of we only care about the outcome. Don't say anything like that. Like, it's hard enough interviewing as it is. And that's the thing. You're just like doing like too much oversharing, making his answers a little bit long, drawn out, which is why sometimes some interviewers ask him like the same question but slightly different because they just couldn't get the answer from what his previous answer was. And so I was like, those would be some reasons possibly why if they passed, those would be why. But if you could clean those up, you could do better.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, also in some of your answers, you need to formulate them in a better like STAR method, but also include some of those buzzwords that were in the job description so they can hit them on their checkbox.
I agree.
So, but that's the thing though. AI told him that he did better than like honestly what we felt he did.
Yeah, I
but that's what I'm saying. It don't have AI don't really have anything to compare to outside of just judging it.
Like that's also why I tell people to record all their interviews. Like you should be able to feel when an interview didn't go well. You should be able to feel when an interview didn't go well. Like, and that's also why mentorship helps. Because you're leveraging someone's experience of already being there to be able to tell you whether or not it was positive. Yeah, but
that's gonna be me on Monday. I ain't prepping all for this freaking. I'm interviewing for a cloud IR. It's like cloud IR analyst or something like that.
I mean, I'm gonna be honest, dude. I probably prep for like less than 10% of my interviews. I only prep for an interview when either the recruiter specifically tells me what I should prep for. Or in the previous round, they tell me, hey, this is what we're going to do for next round. Like, I got a Python assessment, a Python and a Terraform assessment for a next round that I have. I haven't prepped for an interview in like 30, 40, 50 interviews at this point.
Well, I prep based on, depending on like, when they consistent, you don't have to because you really could just build up all the interviews.
Absolutely.
But if it's few and far between and you want to, my stuff a lot of times sometimes be more like either some soft skill based or they may. If we talked in the screen and I'm asking questions so I can get more info, maybe someone's like, oh, hey, cool, I'm going to like do this or just work on this question. It's more so about me either getting stories together or when I come to IR, it would be certain questions that they would ask. Like, I was like, okay, cool. I don't know why they're asking me this because it don't really matter.
Right.
Or, cool, I'm going to go work
on this. That's question. What comes down to companies just writing stuff down on their job description. It'd be so weird. It's so weird, man.
Right. But I mean, because like I said, we could have a whole episode on interviews because it's interesting. There are people out here that are just like, man, I can't pass an interview. I can't get an offer. Some people can't even get an interview.
Skilled people, bro. The skilled people, man. Like, yeah, I feel you on that one.
Yeah, they made these seem like job interview questions. Let's see. And you can't even answer this truthfully because it's going to like, give away too much information, but at a high level, could you talk about like the most like complex cloud migration or infrastructure project you've been a part of and like takeaways from that?
Kind of. I think Kubernetes generally is just very complex, like, overall. Right now, not right now, but in the past, I've worked on a cloud migration to move from a combination of Active Directory and user validation to a fully serverless architecture with Lambda and S3. So more or less, instead of like actually performing the database operations and managing the JSONs associated with the users, we would use a Python script that's kicked off from a Lambda function in AWS to gather the JSON data, doing the post, the get, etc., and storing that in S3 for future Lambda functions to pick up and perform actions with the Python script. So it would be more or less a chain of Lambda functions that are used to abstract away the need for interacting with the database itself. I thought that was pretty cool because it was really two AWS services that took away a need for like a whole team to be doing those things. I think, is that complex? Not really, but I think it's interesting. I think that's
it probably solved the complex problem.
Yeah, for the on-premise people, hell yeah.
Now let's talk real quick about automation. Do you use Tines?
Tines?
Yeah.
I've never heard of that tool.
Yeah, that's like a tool or a platform that a lot of companies have went on to. Like, I'd ask them about, okay, what you guys use for automations? Because a lot of companies want to use SOAR, but they'll say, no, we use Tines for automation. So that might be something you come across for
what automation. What is SOAR? I've seen SOAR come up a lot.
SOAR is Security, Orchestration, Automation, and Response.
Is that a framework, methodology, or actual tool?
It's just a bunch of things placed together. So it's, I guess you could be a methodology, but for the most part, it's a tool. So Palo Alto bought a tool that used to be called Cortex.
Yeah.
It's called XOR. So the problem with security operations is there's so many meticulous and mundane things you have to do. Like, you got to escalate and you got to get this, prepare this together and that. Time is not on your side if it's a real incident going on.
Right.
So what SOAR can do is what we were talking about earlier, like the AI agents in the SOC. Like, if I need to, like, for example, use case, we do emergency offboardings and we got to revoke the people access. When it comes in, the automation looks for the SSO, finds the asset and say, hey, let's go ahead and wipe and disable this.
Right.
So that's something that takes maybe a minute or two when it used to probably take us 5-10, could take longer if you had to make sure what the asset was and go find multiple and go and either contain it in CrowdStrike or contain it like in Google Workspace.
Makes sense.
So, or let's say, hey, there's a big incident going on and we need to create the incident ticket. We need to create the ticket that's an XOR. We need to start PagerDuty to page everybody and we need to start a bridge, whatever. So automation can help you do all those things that would probably take you 30 minutes to an hour to do everything probably condense it in like 5 minutes.
Gotcha.
So that's like when you hear somebody say, like, do you got any experience with SOAR? That's what they're thinking of. Because on the back end, a lot of the SOAR is pretty much ran through Python.
Yeah.
So when you're coding up the stuff, it's like Python scripts.
That's interesting. Yeah. The type of incident response that I've been engaged with was like in regard to service uptime. So more like SRE type roles instead, not necessarily like security related, like literally some production database will go down and then either remediate, document the remediation, uptime, when it occurred, why it occurred,
yeah,
root cause analysis, etc.
That's kind of like, so when I worked in the NOC, it was more so like that. Like, if that's where I first got introduced to Splunk. We use Splunk to monitor like the transactions. So if something started going red, that's when we kind of like started instantly, like, what's going on? Because that means they're not making money. And that's when we had to start the bridge call, doing RCA, trying to figure out what's going on, and getting all these different people on the call. And that's when you get the SREs and then trying to figure out what's going on. Literally happened the other day. It wasn't related. It wasn't anything related to like my team. We had to do anything, but we joined like all major critical incidents and like they had some crap go down and I guess the lines blew up with people calling in about stuff. And you had all the engineers, Citrix guys, AWS guys, everybody's online. They're trying to figure out like what's going on, but they were able to fix it like fairly quickly. I think they used to fail over, but that was like, I mean, you're always in there cause you just never know. I hope it ain't me. Yeah, because like some days I just be chilling. Like,
bro, like do you remember when CrowdStrike had that thing? Was it last year?
Mm-hmm.
With the Windows server, bruh. Mm-hmm. I was up for like 24 hours that day, dude.
I bet. See, we were lucky because we're the team and stuff is leaning up to where they caught it or whatever would have happened. They fixed it. So we didn't run into any issues. But everywhere else, them airports, Delta.
Brother, I don't ever want to do that again.
But that's all those things. So when I'm interviewing and I'm showing them, like, because sometimes I ask, well, how you keep up with current events and yada, yada, yada. I mean, a lot of times it's like, well, I got a Discord, I got a security channel, I got this, I got a podcast. But it's also, I bring up situations like third-party risk management. That was a third-party thing. It's like, hey, why nobody ever combed through the code to figure out exactly what access CrowdStrike has to Windows environments and why it doesn't have the access and what could go wrong if some, you know, a bad update or something started out. And that's literally what happened. Bad QA and also third party. So now that's probably something that they are, you know, redoing. And it's probably one of the things that they probably look for to implement with AI. It's like, hey, go through this. Something that a person may miss, that's where a use case I could see that it'll help additional, like, hands-on to it for stuff like that. I think it's just getting out of hand. Now you also see this is a separate thing, but all these companies are moving away from – they still use a multi-factor, but now they're trying to gun everybody to do passwordless. Because it's so many passwords.
I mean, I might as well.
But it's a chain event. It's like you got your phone, then you got Okta. Then Okta is connected to this other identity platform that's helping you not have to put any but one main password to log in everything. So technically, you're not passwordless, but you are.
Yeah, I'd rather it be tedious and safe than just one password for everything.
Where I see that it benefits is where you have to put in one password one time, like forever that day, it can immediately negate attacks like MFA fatigue, where people know your password, but you still get prompts. Whereas, hey, you don't have the other platform on your phone for it to acknowledge that you put the right password in to access it.
Right.
So it's one of those things. And if you got the hard thing too, it's going to be hard to do for end users. On the customer side, I mean, business side is easy because it's going to be on a work asset or whatever. So it will understand it can log in from here or this work phone.
Right.
You won't be able to do it on your personal. You can do it on your personal phone, but I think it's going to be tougher to do. So we shall see.
We shall see.
Now, I'm probably going to ask you like a couple of questions about, I know we talked a little bit about like if you're wanting somebody to get started, because this kind of stuff that you answer on your lives and your TikTok.
Yeah.
And I want to ask, like, if somebody want to get started in the cloud, or I guess we could segment it. We could say if they want to either get started in the cloud, DevOps, or anything, like, what's your advice to them?
If someone was brand new to getting into IT, the very first thing that I would tell them to do is pursue getting your Security Plus certification. I think that should be the first and number one certification you look for. And the way that you do it is you go on YouTube and you type in Professor Messer Security Plus. You're going to want to look for the 701 version of the exam, go through all of his content in his 701 playlist for Security Plus, and that'll cover everything that you'll need to know about for the exam. From there, you go ahead and get a set of practice exams associated with it. Score 85 across all 6 practice exams. You can get those practice exams from Jason Dion on Udemy for about $20. Score 85% average across all the exams. Take your Security Plus so you can have your cybersecurity fundamentals. But ultimately, you don't need a certification for you to get a job on the help desk. You need to learn Active Directory, ServiceNow, or Active Directory and some ticketing system. It could be Zendesk. And then pick something like Azure, AWS. Get your like a Cloud Foundations understanding. You don't need the certification, but get an understanding of the cloud. Learn how to provision a virtual machine. And you could get a job on the help desk. Mind you, it's just doing password resets and MFA realistically. So I would say if you really wanted to get into tech, that's what I would do for your very first job. It's like IT support or help desk support.
Yeah. And I'm just going to throw a shameless plug in here, man. You know, check out the Course Careers link to do the IT course. We helped a lot. I'm saying we helped, but they helped a lot of people get into IT just off of Josh's back. I'll say that.
Okay.
But would you say that with a little bit more projects and portfolio, they could – it's not really – to me, I don't see that as skipping. I see it as the same vein, but one takes a little bit more skill. Mm-hmm. Instead of starting at help desk, they could go to cloud support.
You could – My perspective on skipping help desk is that you're missing an opportunity to get paid, get your certifications paid for, and get more hands-on experience. Personally, I think your timeline for getting into a true engineering role or a role above the help desk, your mental timeline should be about 6 to 8 months. If you're a very average person, and the vast majority of people are average, your timeline should be about 6 to 8 months. But your timeline for getting into a help desk role should be 60 days or less, in my opinion. I think you should get a job on the help desk so you can be getting paid, getting hands-on training, and get the company to pay for your certifications, and then leverage that to get your certifications, do your portfolio projects, and get into a cloud support or cloud operations role. Ultimately, your timeline should still be about 6 months anyways, but in that 6 month period, I think you should be getting paid and having an employer pay for your certifications rather than you do it yourself.
I agree. And that's where I'm at too with it when it comes to people talking about school and stuff. I'm like, hey, if you get your first IT job,
then you could, they're going to pay for school anyways.
Yeah. So you can get them to do that. And dang it, I had it and then I forgot it. It was about help desk. Oh, also the thing too, I think people run into is when you are trying to get help desk, act like you want to do help desk, because if you say, oh, I'm trying to get security or stuff.
Because they're not going to, because from a business perspective, their thought process is, well, why would I want to hire someone who's going to leave in 6 months? Mm-hmm. You have to display to the company. I don't care if you got to pretend. Pretend like you want to be there for 10 years, right? Pretend like you want to get paid $25 an hour for 10 years, right? But objectively, from a business perspective, it's weird. I've never hired anyone for help desk before, but from their perspective, they might run into some difficulty in hiring someone overskilled for the role if you make yourself appear that way, because then they're going to think, well, he's only going to be here for 6 months and then I'm going to waste my time hiring, training him, etc. But that's the nature of the role. Yeah. Like, they know what's up.
Funny enough, that also happens to skilled people already in IT.
Oh, yeah.
They're trying to apply to jobs like technically you're too skilled for. And you think, well, I just want the job. I was like, well, they looking at your resume, you got a lot of experience. Why you're not applying to roles that's looking for people that's got, you know, 7, 8, 10 years of experience?
Exactly. Like, I had applied for a cloud support role, and one of the interviewer's questions was like, well, with your experience being able to build out cloud environments and all these architectures, like, how would you feel if you had to do a support role? Of course, I lied, and I was like, I don't really care. Like, it's just the cloud. I'm passionate about it, whatever. They didn't move forward with me because they understood, like, this was, like, well above me in terms of skill set.
That happened to me. I tried to do – it's a hospital out here.
Yeah.
I was trying to double up. This is years ago. This is like 2018, like, right after I got my master's. And I was telling him I already had a job. And I was like, yeah, I could – I forgot what he asked me. But he knew, like, man, this dude ain't going – we might as well pass on this, man. Because exactly. He already got somewhere he working at. Why would he want to leave there and come here?
Yeah.
So I was like, dang. I remember that. I had dressed up to go down there and everything. I was going to be doing, like, I don't know if it was help desk or what. I forgot. I was just like, man, I'm going to just find something I could do. Because I think at that time, I might have been working, like, nights or something.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I can do this on certain days so I'm not working. Because that's the one thing about shift work. You can have, if you got some cool places, you have some gravy shifts, you can do 4-10s, or you can do Panama schedule, where you're rotating stuff out. So you have some weeks where you may be off 4 days or something like that. So I was like, I could find something.
Got you. Man, in the cloud world, I mean, you'll have stuff like that if you do like cloud incident response or maybe SRE type deal. But I'll say most of the opportunities that I've been a part of are usually just regular hours, I'll say. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever, I know you talked about it, but have you ever worked a crazy incident?
A crazy incident? The CrowdStrike one, for sure, 100%. That was ridiculous.
Like, where were you, like, so were you out, like,
no,
like
I was
lit somewhere?
I was... I don't want to say what I was doing at that time. Actually, no, I had a guest at that time. And of course, it popped off in the later hours of the night. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, I know you work, but I didn't know that you worked. I was like, well, did you think this was a game? Did you think that I said I was in tech as like a joke? Like, no, I actually have to respond to critical things. But at that time, I think it was pretty late. It was probably like 11, 12. Mm-hmm. I didn't end up getting off until 12 the next time. Like, so that was wild. I'd probably say that one. And then I had a recent one where they just decided to scale down the production database. It was so, not weird, but it was just like, you probably shouldn't have did that. There was no change process either. It was just like, oh, well, we scaled it up to 80 cores to handle a load at the time. And then they figured, okay, well, since we don't have the load, we're just going to scale it down. without like considering that it's going to cause an outage for the next like 15 minutes as it shifts over. I would say that, but but my roles aren't like super duper. I'll say, yes, you have to understand the foundationals of the foundational things of security. You have to understand how to implement certain practices with the cloud services and the tooling as you're building out the architectures. Mm-hmm. Like, objectively, I know my cybersecurity fundamentals and I know how to implement them in the cloud space, but like, I wouldn't say that what I do is truly. Like, I'm not dealing with the what was the multi-factor type of attack that you were talking about? Multi-factor fatigue. Yeah, I'm not dealing with like different types of attacks in a way. Yeah.
Like, I think y'all would deal with the aftermath.
Aftermath and beforehand. Like, it's preventative maintenance.
Like if somebody freaking stood up a lot of freaking what's the thing it's called? Specific like EC2 instances. Like,
yeah.
And like hogged all the resources or started trying to like mine crypto or crap like that. Used to be a big thing that people was weary of.
Yeah, like, and that's the thing about DevOps or DevSecOps. Everything is preventative maintenance. You want to make sure that everything is consistent, that there's a consistent process to automate and deploy things in a secured fashion, so things like that don't happen.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, but you could consider
that. That can happen, but it really depends on who account they get access to.
Absolutely.
And what do they know? How much havoc can they do? And can you catch them in time? Or are you too late responding to it? So that's why they focus on those metrics all the time, the mean time to respond. If that's very high, they're trying to get that down lower. So that's a very important metric to most security operations and incident responders. But another thing I was going to bring up, I seen you agree with this. I said, I know we're going to talk about this on the podcast. Bowtie Cyber. I saw that you agreed with his take about, I forgot how many days.
Certification pathway in 90 days? Yeah. I agree with it. Mind you, that I've made so much shout out to Evan, by the way. His name is Evan. He's actually dope, and I don't recommend a lot of boot camps. I don't even like boot camps.
But you know what? He might be back, but he got ran on Twitter a lot of times.
Oh, 100%. I've heard. I don't use Twitter, guys, by the way. You can find me TikTok and Instagram. But like, I've heard, and as a seasoned cybersecurity professional, I agree with his take. Yes, you can finish those certifications in 90 days, and the pathway makes sense to me. And I've broken this down like several times on TikTok and Instagram. Like, because his pathway is Security Plus, Network Plus in 60 days, AZ900, Splunk Core, and then you get into a SOC analyst type of role, or more specifically, like a network traffic.
Knocker help desk.
Yeah, knocker help desk role. But and on the topic of that help desk statement, right? With those skills, if somebody looked at you applying for a help desk role, they would raise both of their eyebrows and be like, I can't hire this person because they're probably too skilled, in my opinion. But based on those certifications, you can finish all of those in that time frame.
So this is the pushback I gave him because I reacted to him. I've grilled him so many times. While I think some people can do it, and that's only because from over 5 years I've had people that have had all these certifications, they weren't able to get into security because a lot of people just passed and they didn't learn anything.
And
because it's like how many of us were in college where you like,
you just got a bachelor's type deal.
Like, I don't remember nothing I learned the last semester because I just had to learn it. The portfolio could help them, but a lot of them, just like how we talked about earlier, they're not equipped to answer the questions that they would have to do on the job just because that's not what they zero in on. They learn a lot of different things, which in time will help them. But in that short amount of time, some people, well, I say most people can't do it. The elite of the elite have the ability to learn that fast and do it. And I think that's where I was telling them, like, I disagree for everybody to do this because I don't think everybody can, because I also factored in, I feel like that way is better for people who have no type of responsibilities.
Yeah, like I agree with you on that. The type of person that can finish something like that is an above average person. I dare say an exceptionally above average person.
Yes, they
are. Who can either make it happen because they have the sacrifice or they have the time to do so. That, like, finishing all of those in 90 days and getting a role is not common, but ultimately, like, who wants to be average? I'm pretty sure everybody who's watching this podcast right now, you don't want to be average and you want to get into cybersecurity. And if you actually want to or be competitive in the tech space, you can't be average. So if you're already like, okay, well, it's not realistic for average people.
But you know what? We say that, but we work with a lot of people who are average. Like, they just been at the company. for so long.
But okay, like the people who've been at companies for super long, like the people who really have the old archaic, oh, I started on the help desk, and then after X amount of years and X amount of years and X amount of years, those days are gone. If you want to stay at a company for 10 years and raise through the ranks, you should have did that 2 decades ago. Because if you really want to be competitive, in my opinion, in 2025, you're going to have to want to pursue a pathway like that. But yeah, there are average people in the field, but they're not there because they just got there. They're there because they've been average for years, I think.
Yeah. So I was like, that's what I was saying. That was like my gripe with him. But it's funny because it's like a clan of bow tie people.
Yeah.
It's like, bro.
Because, I mean, he's made like legitimate like six-figure earners with that pathway. Like I've seen it. Like they're real. But as we said, like it's not. Everybody's not going to come out like that.
That's the reason why, like, I've always been a person that I push for people. If that stuff makes sense, that's why, like, I really love, like, Josh's stuff because it's doable.
Matacore?
Yeah.
Shout out to Matacore. I've had several people from his camp, like, join my mentorship. They'll come in with some skills, boy. They'll come in like, I already know how to do the thing. They just don't know how to find a job.
Yeah. And I work with people, too. Like, when we do consults, I'm like, hey, go do this. When you get some skills, come back to me.
Yeah, because literally, I had a guy, his name is Trevor. I got a video with him in my community. I got him into a role in 2 weeks. But he already had his foundations from Matacore in terms of, like, the portfolio. He just didn't know how to, like, put it all together. Yeah. Those are the type of people that I would love to work with who just have the skills but don't know how to – they don't have the job hunting skills or the interview skills.
Yeah.
Because I could show you that. But, like, yeah, I definitely agree.
That's why I try to work with more people like that. So now that the person is in help desk, what else should they learn now to where they become cloud engineer, cloud support? Like what should they be doing?
Yeah. So this, in my opinion, is the certification pathway that you would want to get into if you want to get into the cloud in 2025. Let me say that again. So this is the cloud certification pathway or pathway that I think you should do if you want to get into the cloud in 2025. I think you should start with your Security Plus. Let's say you're already on the help desk. You have your Security Plus. I think afterwards, your first certification should be either between the Cloud Foundations on AWS or the AZ900 on Azure. For all intents and purposes, I'm just going to say the Azure pathway because that's the route that I took. So it'd be Security Plus, AZ900 to get your cloud fundamentals down so you're familiar with what the cloud is and you're familiar with it on one particular platform. From there, you're going to pursue your AZ-104. Your AZ-104 is your Azure Administrator Associate. That's going to validate that you truly understand how the platform works and how to do administration and engineering on the platform. If you finish your AZ-104 legitimately, you should know how to build things. You should know how to build environments, troubleshoot things, etc. on the Azure platform. From there, I would tell you to get your Terraform Associate. So, if you're not familiar with Terraform, it's an automation tool it's an agnostic automation tool for cloud platforms that allows you to automate the deployment of different pieces of infrastructure. When I was saying earlier, you could deploy a whole cloud environment. You're going to use Terraform to do that. It's an industry standard tool. So I would say learn that. And then the next certification, in my opinion, I think it would be either your GitLab associate or your Azure DevOps engineer associate. Right now, that's your AZ-400. That would give you a repository, a pipeline tool, an automation tool for doing deployments to any cloud platform. Right, you could use that on Azure, AWS, or GCP. So after you develop your fundamentals with Security Plus and the Azure certifications, you're learning two agnostic tools that can be used on any other cloud platform, Terraform and Azure DevOps. In my opinion, that's how I would tell someone to get in the cloud. Like, it just makes sense to me.
Huh. No, great, great, great. Now, what I do want to go into briefly is you mentioned about clients and your community. I want you to give you an opportunity to talk about that as far as, you know, what you offer and who you're looking for or your ideal client is.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to preface this by saying I do not want to work with everybody. I don't. Like, I want to work with people who understand the concept of investing in something. Because you're not going to make six figures for nothing. Like, that's just not realistic. I also said before, I'm not like a people person, but I fooled you clearly. So I mesh with certain people, but I also don't. So I will say that, like, even if you're not considering working with me or Bowtie Cyber or whoever, pick someone that you like and that also likes you. Now, with my community, I started it last year in December because I wanted to have a place where I could put the resources that I wish that I had at the start of my career in one place. And I made my community free because I wish that I had that when I was just starting. Because if I did, I'd probably be further along in my career with the knowledge that I have now. And within that, I have my private mentorship community where I work with people end to end until they sign a job offer that they're happy with. Right. And when I say end to end, I mean literally until you sign that first job offer that you're looking for. Now, it's done with you support. And what I mean by that is I could tell you what to do, when to do it, why to do it, and how to do it. But ultimately, I can't do it for you, which is why it's done with you support. And I walk people through a process from end to end that is, one, getting you skilled up, really doing a skill set assessment to figure out what you're actually capable of doing in terms of your technical skill, and identifying an end goal or a role that we're searching for. And from there, once we figure out like what you're trying to get into, then we'll dive into projects and certifications that align with the skills that you need for you to get into the role, right? So if someone was pursuing a cloud support role, we would build out a pathway specifically based on the skill set that they're already coming in with, right? From there, step number two is just teaching you how to actually source positions, right? Looking for a role is a skill set. You have to learn that skill. And it's just teaching you how to put yourself in a position where recruiters are reaching out to you on a daily basis rather than you looking for a role on a day-to-day basis with like cold applications, right? And then after step two, step three is interview prep. So just making sure that you understand how to interview, like me prepping you for an interview and you also getting access to my interviews. And mind you, I record all of my interviews. So over the course of like the last, 8 years or so, I have like 200 plus interviews. So you're getting the prep, but you're also getting access to the full audio and video. So you can see the body language, the tonality, the type of responses, what are good and bad. And then the fourth step is offer negotiation, right? So once you have skills, once you know how to look for positions, and once you know how to interview, you will get a job offer. It is inevitable. But a lot of people haven't seen their first job in tech, and they also haven't seen $100,000 before. And when they do, they immediately sign it without thinking of other value outside of a base salary. So that's why I made the fourth step just offer negotiation, making sure that you're saying the right things, the right emails, having the right conversations to maximize the offer that you're getting, and you're not lowballing yourself. So that's what I do for my mentees, and that's what I do for myself. That's how I would describe the process that I use for me to like get from where I started to where I am now.
Right. And I forgot to ask you this because we're on cloud DevOps. Mm-hmm. We've seen you do your interviews before, but what could somebody look to make working in either being a cloud engineer, DevOps? You got a hybrid role.
Yeah, I would say you could look to make anywhere between $50 to $110 an hour. I would say that's a good range.
And that translates to about $100,000 to $200,000 to what, $25,000 or something like that?
Correct.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. The longer you work and you start seeing stuff higher, you can calculate what they're doing without even looking at it.
Right. I didn't even say a salary. I said an hourly dollar rate. Yeah, but that just comes with time, I guess.
Yeah. And you don't do this because we know who do this, but I guess I'll ask you, do you also do any like consulting?
It'll depend on the project. I'll say it'll depend on the project and what they're actually looking for. Some companies think they need Kubernetes. Every company does not need Kubernetes, but it depends. I'm very much open to stuff like that as long as I understand what the scope is.
Bet. So, and let me check this real quick. So I make sure that I ask you all the cool stuff. These are some job interview questions. Okay. So these will be more reflection type questions. One is like, what's one piece of advice you give to someone aspiring to be a cloud and DevOps engineer, especially one aiming for multi-cloud expertise?
I would say pick one cloud platform from the start. Inevitably, you will be forced to learn a second cloud platform. But pick one and niche down on that platform. And personally, I would tell you to pick between Azure or AWS. You can choose GCP, but it's the bronze medal. And honestly, picking between Azure and AWS would be a safer choice. Just pick one, do a deep dive, niche down on that singular platform. And inevitably, you will come at a point in your career where you'll be forced to learn a second one. And then by all intents and purposes, you will be classified as a multi-cloud engineer. But I wouldn't immediately start my career and pursue multiple cloud platforms like I did. I don't think that was an efficient usage of my time, but I wouldn't do it again.
Bet. And then last one, what's the most rewarding aspect of your job?
The money.
I knew you was going to say that.
The money. Like, I'm not going to hold y'all, boy. I'm still 26, man. The money good, man. I'm not going to hold you. It's the money. Yes, it's the money. I'm passionate about it, but I like value and I like money, and I provide value to businesses and they pay me well.
Yeah. It's funny because when I asked you about what was your one piece of advice going to be, I thought you were going to say, nobody cares. I so badly want to name this episode Nobody Cares, but I know it will not work for my algorithm. Like, if I was Joe Budden, I could name it Nobody Cares and people would click. If I do Nobody Cares, nobody's going to care. Oh, man. But you said it before. How can our listeners and our watchers, how can they keep up with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You guys can find me on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Cloud Tech Exec. I'm going to be posting some long-form content shortly, but you can find me on those two. And then also, if you're interested in my school and my community, you can find it at school.com/cloudtechexec as well.
All right. And you guys know where to find me at, but I forgot. And I ain't been saying this. If you want to leave a voicemail for the show, look in the description and click the link. I think I put the link in there for you to leave a voicemail so we can answer it live on real time. Or if you want to send us a question, the group mailbox email is in the description as well, so you can send us that and just rock with us. And if you want to become a member, check out some of the members-only content that I have on YouTube now. I may be moving away from Patreon a little bit because I guess, you know, most of y'all on YouTube. But until next time, let's stay textual, and we out. Peace.